Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Nexus Sunday Morning Online. Glad you're with us. Glad you have joined us. And before we jump into Lent Week 2, just a few things to bring you up to speed about. Hopefully, if you tuned in last week, you know that we're doing this matching donation campaign with One for Another, and they just do incredible work in Uganda, and so we're hoping to help them out throughout the months of March. So you can find more details about that in the Nexus Weekly. Also, if you missed Glenn's announcement about that last week, check out last week's video. It's all there, but would love to have as many people as possible jump in on that so we can help out some children in Uganda in need of surgery. So there's that. Second thing, we're hosting a Nexus family meeting on Sunday, March 27th. And for those of you watching online, things are starting to open up a little bit. We're going to host this family meeting in person, Sunday, March 27th. It will directly follow the service. I'm hoping many of you might maybe feel comfortable to join us for that morning. But if not, we'll get you some information online here as well about what we're going to cover that at the family meeting. But some big decisions we need to make as a community. So hopefully maybe I'll see you in person Sunday, March 27th for that service and that family meeting. Last thing is this. We've been doing this for 2 years now. My goodness. Wow. 2 years, this online thing. And we're thinking about making some changes in the next couple of weeks. So 2 Sundays left in this format where Dave and I do our thing. And we're trying, it's proven to be a little bit more difficult than we imagined, but we're trying to maybe pull off a live stream from the Conrad for Sunday morning. So it would not be this, but you get to peek in on Sunday mornings at the Conrad Center. But again, that's proving a little bit elusive. So we're going to try for 2 more weeks to see if we can get that figured out. If not, though, then we're going to switch to a video podcast, you could say. So what that will mean, changes here on Sunday morning, is that essentially you're just going to get me. Boom, 10:30, my face will be here. We start, I do my sermon. That's the thing. So doing some shifting here as we continue through this, but just want to make you aware of some changes coming. So we'll see. We don't know if we're going to be able to pull off the live stream or if it'll be video podcasts, but in about 2 weeks, that's coming. So stay tuned for that. But thank you so much for joining us. We are in our second week of Lent, and I hope it's more difficult here online, but I hope you've been able to connect with sort of the mosaic, you could say, that we're swinging together for this Lent. And my desire was throughout this to combine stories and scripture and art and song and film into some meaningful reflections around Lent as we journey towards Easter. And hopefully you have been able to connect maybe with some of that. Now, I'm going to be talking about some song and film this morning, so hopefully we can make this work online here. But last week, we reflected on how life is difficult. And, you know, Lent can be a bit of a somber season. We're going to make the turn eventually, but we're diving in even a little bit deeper this morning because I want to explore grief and loss. And again, I want to do that through scripture and art and song and film. And so that's what we're going to try to piece together this morning. And so this morning is simply grief observed. And where do you begin with that? Well, why not begin with Dolly Parton? I think it likely impossible that we don't know who she is. I'm sure everybody knows her at least a little bit, is a bit familiar with her music. But for me, it wasn't until I took a deep dive into her music via a podcast. It was called Dolly Parton's America. And until I listened through that podcast series, I didn't fully understand her brilliance as a musician and a performer. And not only is she a prolific songwriter recording hits across the decades, but it surprised me that her life and work has been analyzed on some deep academic levels. And she's credited, Dolly Parton, with being something you could say of a poster girl, a spokesperson for feminism, her career and work a model for at least the first 3 waves of feminism. But what really caught my attention in learning about Dolly Parton was the experience people kept describing about being at one of her live shows. And this is where I really started to get curious, because what I kept hearing was that for fans who go to Dolly Parton shows, it feels to them like the most diverse place and group of people you can imagine being with. I mean, according to Shima Olay, to attend her concert is to experience something like this. People wearing cowboy hats and boots, people in drag, church ladies, lesbians holding hands, little girls. It's a picture of all of these different slices of America jammed together. Groups of people that we think shouldn't get along, but there they are standing side by side, polite, singing the same song. Now, I've never been to a Dolly Parton concert. I don't know if I'll ever get that opportunity, but after hearing that, boy, do I want to go. I would love to experience that. And why it stuck out to me is that started to feel to me, remind me of what I think church can be at its best. People we think shouldn't get along, standing side by side, politely singing the same song. Oh, that's a vision. And I mean, in this sense, you could almost think of Dolly Parton as one of America's greatest pastors. She's a bridge, a person who brings people together rather than stoking the fires of division. But I think many of us know her, of course, as a bit of a larger-than-life sort of entertainer. But there's also, besides her live concerts, there's a brilliance to her work that I'm only beginning to appreciate now. And Nadine Hubb, she's a professor of music and cultural studies at the University of Michigan. She's written extensively about Dolly Parton. She keeps circling back to one song of hers, Jolene. And she calls this a brilliant reimagining, you could say, of an entire subgenre of music. In fact, she believes that in the entirety of Dolly's music catalog, this one song, Jolene, will be the one that is studied even hundreds of years from now. And of course, to understand its brilliance, you have to understand a little bit about the universe, you could say, of country music. And I confess, I know very little about country music, but according to Nadine, within the universe of country music, there are solar systems, subgenres, you could say, and they all follow a typical pattern. So within country music, you have what is called the other woman song, which is a subcategory of the cheating song. Now, of course, the cheating song is usually sung by a man who's brokenhearted because his love has cheated on him, he's lamenting. But within the country music universe, there are literally thousands of these songs, these cheating songs. But there's also underneath that, if you go into that solar system, that galaxy, there's also a subgenre called the other woman song. Women singing about other women, not toward their man, but toward the woman who is poised to steal their man. Now, that's just one of the things country music does. And when country music artists sing about the other woman or to the other woman, these songs can get a little bit nasty. And there are hundreds of these songs within country music. A prime example might be the song Fist City by Loretta Lynn. And the lyrics go a little something like this: "You better close your face and stay out of my way if you don't want to go to Fist City." I mean, that's the whole genre of the other woman song. You're threatened by this other woman and it might come to fisticuffs, you could say. But with Jolene, Dolly totally subverts the whole genre, both lyrically and musically. Now, again, I don't know a whole lot about technical aspects of music, but the guitar riff of the song, it forms this almost hypnotizing loop. It gives you this sort of pacing feeling, like you can almost picture Dolly in her frustration pacing around with her thoughts. And apparently, again, this song is in minor, but not quite regular minor. Apparently, it at least nods towards something called Dorian mode in music. It's primordial, it's primitive, you could say. It's tapping into an ancient struggle. And so the sound hints of the song at this something primitive going on. It's incredibly catchy to listen to the song. But what intrigues me about this song more than anything else is that unlike the vast majority of other women's songs, Dolly isn't looking to start a fight here. And she's not trying to intimidate the other woman, this Jolene character. Instead, the song forms, you could say, a desperate plea. Please don't take my man. And by the end of the song, we find no resolution and we're left haunted by this unfinished story. My happiness depends on you and whatever you decide to do, Jolene. Now, I'm guessing a few minutes in here, you're going, okay, grief and loss, what does this have to do with, you know, this country song? And this is the interesting thing for me. On one level, the song is, of course, simply about a woman hoping she doesn't lose her man to this other beautiful woman. But here's the power of music. We know that once a song is released into the universe, right, it can take on a life of its own. And Dolly herself has said the song actually came about in a very simple way for her. She met a young fan, and this young fan's name was Jolene, and Dolly thought to herself, oh, I'd like to make a song with that name in it. And so to keep the song stuck in her head, she just kept repeating Jolene, 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 Jolene. And that was the birth of the song, the genesis of the song. But what Dolly ended up producing is a song that taps into something much more universal, much more powerful than just a story about another woman. What it captures in this song, I believe, is a universal fear that something more powerful than us will rob us of the things we love most. What this song is at its core is a frightful recognition that in life there are forces more powerful than us that could take what we love most in this world. The things that bring us love and happiness and joy, those things could be stolen from us by powers beyond us. And it captures the face of that fear, you could say, our fear over the things we don't have control of. I mean, consider the story of Tokyo Sex Whale. And he was a South African man. He ended up imprisoned on Robben Island Maximum Security Prison in the late 70s and 80s. And he ended up spending 13 years in this prison alongside none other than Nelson Mandela. In his own prison cell actually sat beside Nelson Mandela's. And he tells an interesting story. He says, at a certain point in the imprisonment, he recalls that the prison guards eventually allowed Nelson Mandela to play music over the loudspeakers for the entire prison to hear. And as Sex Whale recalls, one of Nelson Mandela's favorite songs to play in prison was none other than Jolene. Why? He recalls it this way. I just think about Night at Robben Island in the dark when Jolene was playing over the loudspeakers. The prisoners hear the song in their cells. And on the other side of the wall, the guards are listening too. Both groups of people are having the same experience. The song is not about love. It's about the fear of losing everything. The prisoners feel that because they've lost their freedom. And the guards feel that too because their country's changing and they can sense they're about to lose power. Both are feeling the same fear in the song, but for very different reasons. We're all human beings, the jailed and the jailer, but we all don't want to lose. Whether it's a man or your country, nobody wants to be hurt by loss. I mean, consider the lines of the song again. I'll play Jolene for you in a moment here, but there's a desperation there that Sex Whale taps into, this fear of loss. I mean, consider some of Dolly Parton's words in this song. Please don't take him just because you can. I can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene. Jolene, I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Please don't take him just because you can. I could never love again. He's the only one for me. My happiness depends on you. And whatever you decide to do, Jolene, I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Please don't take him even though you can. Jolene. The song is about the universal human fear of losing everything that our happiness depends on. The song is about the great fear of knowing that we stand in front of forces that are more powerful than us, forces that can rob us of what we love most in this world. And so Jolene in the song, yes, she's the gorgeous other woman who can take your man away, sure, but Jolene is also that affair that could destroy your life, that accident. Jolene is cancer and dementia, the heart attack, that disease, war, ultimately death. Jolene is a stand-in for every force in this world that is capable of robbing us of the things we love most. Let's listen in.
Of auburn hair with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene. Understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene. Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you. Choice of men, but I could never love again. He's the only one for me, Jolene. I had to have this talk with you. My happiness depends on you and whatever you decide to do, Jolene.
What a fantastic song. And again, it points home as we listen to the desperation in the song, the haunting melody. We live with the universal human fear of losing everything that our happiness depends on. And this, of course, brings us to Edvard Munch, great famous painter. And you will no doubt be familiar with his work. His most popular image is, of course, The Scream. And I love this painting. It's a powerful image showing the disorienting experience of fear, of loss. And The Scream is instantly recognizable to many of us because fear and loss are instantly recognizable human emotions. But for this morning, for this Lent, I'm even more taken by one of his other works, The Sick Child. You see, before Munch arrived on the art scene in Norway and Europe, the Norwegian art scene, it was dominated by painters within the naturalist school. And at the time, naturalism, many thought that naturalism in art was essentially the golden age because the works of naturalism bring like near photographic precision to the canvas. And here's some good examples. Let me throw two up for you. Some good examples of prevailing Norwegian style in the 19th century. And this first one is simply called Breakfast by Gustav Wenzel, painted in 1882. And again, you can see there just precision. It's got a photographic quality to it. Or this is Burial at Sea by Carl Sundhansen, painted in 1890. And again, you can see the image almost looks like a photograph. It's an early photograph, you could say. And it was thought that this was the golden age of painting. Because at the time, the highest art possible was to simply capture what one could see and put it on a canvas. That was the highest aim. But then Munch bursts onto the scene and he paints this, The Sick Child. And it's interesting because the sick child was initially received as grotesque. When it was first exhibited, it is said that on the opening day of the exhibition, people gathered around to look around it and they burst out into laughter. Like, this canvas, it looks cloudy, it looks blurry. This was not even close to the artistic talent of the realists and the naturalists. And yet in this moment of public shame, you could say, Munch had found his greatest artistic achievement. He had launched within Norway, you could say, and beyond that, a new form of art called expressionism. And in expressionist art, the subjective and internal are just as significant as the objective and external, the material. And so the style here is not designed to represent things as they are, as they appear, but rather to evoke a particular mood, is to point to something, an emotion, point to something deeper, something internal. And I believe what Munch captures here in this portrait is the essence of grief and loss. It is to see the world through a veil of tears. You see, the sick child records a moment and a memory for Munch. And so take a look again, because what we're looking at here for Munch is actually the scene of his sister's deathbed. His oldest sister, Johann Sophie, died from tuberculosis when she was only 15. And Munch returned to this deeply traumatic event again and again in his art. In fact, he completed 6 variations of this piece, The Sick Child, did 6 pieces of it over a span of 40 years. And in all 6 of the works, Sophie is typically shown on her deathbed, and she's accompanied right by a dark-haired grieving woman assumed to be her mother. And in all the painted versions, Sophie is lying in bed, obviously suffering from pain. She's shown here with a haunted expression, clutching hands with her grief-stricken mother, who seems to want to comfort her, but whose head is bowed as if she almost can't even look the younger girl in the eye. And the interesting thing is Munch nearly died from tuberculosis himself as a child. And so this work for him became a means to record both his feelings of despair and sadness at the loss of his sister, but there was also a sense of survivor's guilt. It haunted him his whole life. Why had he survived tuberculosis and his sister passed away? And so what Munch creates for us here is not a photographic timestamp of an event and a memory, a moment in history. No. What Munch captures here for us in this sister's, this memory of his sister, is he gives us a lens for grief and guilt and sadness. Because the image, look again, it looks blurry because we, the viewer, are asked to see this image as Munch remembers it, a scene he witnesses while weeping himself. This portrait is the essence of grief and loss. To see the world through a veil of tears. And it's interesting because apparently in the National Gallery in Oslo in Norway, next to the exhibit, what you can see is a stunning sort of sequence of X-ray images that have been done on this painting, and they uncover some of the layers of paint that Munch used in the creative process to make this work. And one of those layers, it's no longer visible to the naked eye, but you can see its effect it has on the painting. But one of these layers reveals this layer of thin paint running down the canvas. And what Munch was trying to convey here was what it was like to watch his sister pass away as he wept for her. We fear the loss and grief that Dolly Parton sings of, that thing that could take the things we love the most away for us. And when that eventually comes and happens to us all, the experience of loss and grief, the experience of losing the things we love most, the people we love most, it is, as Munch would tell us, to see the world forever through a veil of tears. And I think there's a truth to that for anyone who has lost someone they love in this world, be it a spouse, a sibling, a friend, a parent. I think that experience leaves us as humans forever altered. It leaves us looking, gazing at the world through a veil of tears. And I believe that God, through Christ, shares this experience with us, shares this view of the world, shares that in common with those who grieve. I mean, in the great suffering servant songs of the book of Isaiah, Jesus is prophesied about, right? Jesus, the coming Messiah, is described this way, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we see portraits of Jesus' grief throughout the Gospels, perhaps most poignantly in the story of Lazarus, where he loses his good friend Lazarus and weeps. But the Gospels contain another portrait of Jesus crying, Jesus, man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, weeping. And it's found in Luke 19 as Jesus finds himself traveling by path towards the city of Jerusalem. And at one point, he comes to a spot where he can see the whole city. And this is what unfolds. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. And the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in from every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. Again, this is the second portrait we have of Jesus weeping in the Gospels. The first is for his friend, a personal friend, but here he weeps over a city, a people. And he gazes over this city of Jerusalem that he loves. For the Hebrew people, Jerusalem is just so important. And he sees this city and he begins to weep because he knows what's coming. He knows it's going to be lost. And of course, we know the story in AD 70, you know, Rome launched siege warfare, completely destroyed, leveled the city. And Jesus knows this is coming. He can see it coming. And looking over the city, he just weeps in his grief. He weeps at a world that refuses to follow the way of peace, the way of Jesus' path. And so there he stands overlooking Jerusalem, but he can only see Jerusalem through his veil of tears. And you know, I believe that is how God sees and responds to all of our losses and sufferings. I believe that's how God responds to all cities coming under siege, which is important to know right now. How does Jesus look at Ukraine? I believe he sees it through a veil of tears, through weeping. What is God's response to war in Ukraine today? I firmly believe God weeps. And what is God's response to your loss and your hurt? God weeps. God weeps at the suffering, at the loss, at the grief. But God also gives us reason to hope. This brings us to, I think, my favorite film of 2021, the film Nomadland. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it because it's a film that gives us another portrait of grief within its story. And the film is really, really inventive because what it does is it actually blends documentary and fiction. And so Fern, the lead character in the film, played by the always brilliant Frances McDormand, but she is, of course, a fictional character, but everyone else, or a lot of other people in the movie, a lot of the other characters, they're playing themselves. They're actual nomads living out of their vans across the country, all of them weary from their travels, looking for temporary work. And so the film combines fiction and reality, you could say, but at its core, Nomadland is the story of loss and grief. And every single person in the film, whether fictional or real, all of them carry around a very personal story of grief. And I think the great message of the film is that the experience of grief is like losing your sense of home in the world. To know loss and grief in this world is to forever feel a sense of being without home. When we lose the ones we love, we also lose our sense of home, our sense of belonging. To grieve, I think you could say, is to feel like a nomad, never quite comfortable or at home in this life anymore. And the film is not all bleak. It's just stunningly beautiful. It's buoyed by moments of genuine laughter, a sense of camaraderie on the road, and of course, these stunning vistas of landscapes and experiences many of us will never have. But the film dares us to hope. There's one particular powerful scene in the film. I want to show it to you here. In this scene, Fern's fictional character is sharing her story of how she lost her husband, how they lost the town that they lived in. And in this scene, she talks about her loss. She's a fictional character, but she also, in the scene, we see a real American nomad talking with her. His name is Bob, who also shares about his personal loss. And in this scene, this fictional character and this real-life character, they share their experiences of grief. And in it, Bob dares the viewer to hope.
Bo never knew his parents, and we never had kids. If I didn't stay, if I left, it would be like he never existed. I couldn't pack up and move on. He loved Empire. He loved his work so much. He loved being there. Everybody loved him. So I stayed. Same town, same house. It's like my dad used to say, what's remembered lives. I maybe spent too much of my life just remembering Bob. You know what I mean?
I can relate. I rarely ever talk about my son, but today would be his 33rd birthday, and 5 years ago he took his life. And I can still barely say that in a sentence. And for a long time, every day was, the question was, how can I be alive on this earth when he's not? And I didn't have an answer. And those were some hard, hard days. But I realized that I could honor him by, helping people and serving people. It gives me a reason to go through the day. Some days that's all I've got. And out here, there's a lot of people our age, and inevitably there's grief and loss. And a lot of them don't get over it either. And that's okay. That's okay. One of the things I love most about this life is that there's no final goodbye. You know, I've met hundreds of people out here, and I don't ever say a final goodbye. I always just say, I'll see you down the road. And I do. And whether it's a month or a year or sometimes years, I see them again. And I can look down the road and I can be certain in my heart that I'll see my son again. You'll see Bo again. And you can remember your lives together then.
Grief is to forever experience the world through a veil of tears. It's to forever travel through life without a home to return to, you could say. And yet, grief also dares us to hope. Dream that maybe we will see our loved ones again down the road. And I love this sequence in the film where Bob shares his sort of worldview. And it's interesting as the film ends, I won't give away any spoilers, but the closing scene is a closing line of dedication. And it simply reads this as the movie ends: to the ones who had to depart, see you down the road. And so to grieve is to experience the world through a veil of tears. Yes, it's to experience or sense that we've lost any sort of home feeling in this world. Yes, but the experience of grief is also a dare to hope. And the Jesus path offers that to us as well. And that's why I love that Bob says, see you down the road. It matches so perfectly with our understanding of the Jesus path to those who depart, to those we have lost. For the Christian, it is never goodbye. It is see you down the road. And why? Because we have hope. What does Jesus say in the Beatitudes? Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And I don't think Jesus is speaking here just of, someone can come around you and comfort you in the grief. I believe Jesus is speaking to a full and final comforting. Or think about the book of Revelation, how the story closes, right? Again, I come to this often, Revelation 21. Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. I think grief and loss are the things we fear most in life. The thought of losing those closest to us is a terrifying prospect. As Dolly Parton sings in Jolene, there are things in life we know, whether it's age or disease, whatever it is, there's those things, those powers in life that can steal from us the things we love most. And we live in fear of that. And those people, those things constitute home for us. And when that eventually comes, as it surely will for all of us at some point, that experience of loss and grief is then to forever see the world through a veil of tears. It's to forever feel not quite at home. But that experience of grief and loss is also an invitation, a dare to hope. It dares us to ask and trust that maybe we will see our loved ones again down the road. It's an experience that dares us to trust and believe that we who mourn will one day be comforted, that our tears will be wiped away. But in the meantime, our trust, our hope, our sense of peace and comfort is to know that God weeps and grieves alongside of us. Friends, thank you for joining us this morning as we reflected on grief and loss, grief observed, you could say, and I hope there was something in there, and not every week in Lent is going to be, you know, this sort of somber. We will turn the page, but I wanted this to be a sort of bookend with Easter. I'm going to return to this week on Easter Sunday, but thanks for joining with us as we move through these rather hard, dark themes. It's a part of Lent. It's a part of journeying towards the hope and celebration of Easter, but thanks again for joining us for this week. May you go in peace.